session is called The Risks and Beauty of Hyperpublic Life. This morning, Jonathan said, well, you know, this is yet another privacy conference, and so I just want to emphasize it's also a publicness conference, and to some extent, this is a session that deals with that, is that there's also a huge temptation to do things that are very, very public. There's fascinating things that can be done with that. There's, you know, both dystopian and utopian images of the city of the future where we could see the tracks of things, we can see all the data, we could see the movement. And so a lot of the idea in this session is to look at what are the sort of beautiful and tempting things that we can have in the hyper-public world, and what are their risks, but also what is the value from it. This session will be chaired by Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor at the City University Graduate School of Journalism. And he is, as many of you know, a widely read blogger about media and news at buzzmachine.com. He's the author of What Would Google Do? And an upcoming book called Public Parts on Privacy and Publicness. So thank you.
Thank you. I haven't been to Berkman for some time, and I just absolutely love hanging out with smart kids. This is just such an amazing institution and the leader of the internet, and so I know I speak for the world in saying thank you, Berkman, for doing this. I'm also grateful that you constructed this whole day around not the word privacy. Jonathan was wrong. It's not another privacy conference. It's the first publicness conference, is the way I want to look at it. And I think that the two necessarily then become into discussion one way or the other. But to look at it from both sides, I think, is incredibly important. Just one bit of maybe transition from the morning sessions. As my brain was swimming and my Twitter feed was going crazy, thanks mainly because everybody retweeted Dana all morning, is the notion, ending out with where Ethan was, that I think what we need personally is principles to inform the architecture and operation of where we're going. That we need to give, what we do now is wait for the service to give us the terms of service. And we should have a terms of service for the internet, in a way, to give to these institutions, these corporations, these governments. And I don't suggest there's a constitution or one set of laws. All I suggest is we need a discussion. And out of that discussion, we'll start to intuit discern where we go with these principles. And I think that's what I hear happening today, is trying to discern the principles of what it means to have a public and where that goes. We're going to talk about objects and cities and data. One thing that I'd like to keep in mind that I think was great out of the discussion of Street View this morning, and when the Germans have their right of Verpixelungsrecht, the right to be pixelated, as they call it, and 244,000 Germans chose to have their homes pixelated in Germany, and then others objected because one resident of the building would have it pixelated, the other resident wanted it to be clear, and it was typically wonderfully German. But part of my objection to what I saw happen in Germany, that was one point I didn't hear this morning that I would just like to add to the discussion, is that there was a diminishment of the public. There was a diminishment of the public space, the public view, and thus the public good and what the public owns. And that's an issue here in deciding what's public. It's also important to keep in mind that kind of we all have a stake in that and that it is a public good. And so as we discuss what it means to have both privacy and publicness in public and what does it mean to have a public, I think we have to look at it with some proprietary interest in that, an ownership interest in that as the public. Is there any other point I want to make? The other interesting thing that I hear from this morning is that I think that, we talk about the English home with the back stairs and the hallway inventing privacy, the notion that Dana mentioned too about the switch of default on privacy and publicness, that privacy was for so long, was a scarcity, and it's now a scarcity again. Privacy used to be expensive, then it was free, now it's expensive again. I find it a fascinating economic route here that goes, that's changing the economics of this and our presumptions about this and how we look at the world through the architecture of both our spaces and our places and also our systems. Finally, I've been struggling a lot with the metaphor for the internet, it was Doc Searles who taught me that to not call it a medium, because when we call it a medium, it brings the limitations and the desires to control it that a medium brings. and Doc taught me to call it a place. And as I've called it that on my blog, some people objected to that. The CTO of the Veterans Administration calls it the Eighth Continent, so it's kind of a new place. But that kind of makes us assume as if we're all leaving for Plymouth Rock and we're leaving our old homes, when in fact we remain resident in our old homes. We become citizens also of this new space. And Sarkozy at the EG8 refused to call it a parallel universe. I guess the internet, in my mind, is a platform for publics. It's a platform that enables us to come together and create publics, and that also enables us to have the ability to do that as private people. And we're trying to find the balance of that. But I think the important thing to discuss is that there are benefits to publicness. There are benefits to being able to gather together and act, to speak and act together as a public. And how we architect that world is what's going to enable what happens and what can't happen. So that's my little preamble. And I'll pass over to each of the panelists who will do up to 10 minutes of a talk. And then I hope we're going to have lots of discussion in the room. So I will have had my say, so I'll shut up. That's a lie. But go running around the room and so store up your comments and challenges. So, Adam first.
Good afternoon. My name is Adam Greenfield. I'm a director of a shop in New York City called Urban Scale. And we, our tagline is designed for networked cities and citizens. So we are very deeply invested in the idea of how do you design networked spaces that support the sorts of publics and the sorts of public debates, discussions, activities that we've all been concerned with so far today. I'm interested in pushing back at some of the notions that we receive around this figure of the networked city. The networked city is often offered to us as existing in what certain people in the room call a proximate future. And I mean to push back very distinctly at that. I don't mean that the networked city lives in a proximate future at all. I think that we already live in the networked city, or what we call the smart city as well. And why is that? Well, we've got a pervasively, even a comprehensively instrumented population, not merely in all of the cities of the developed world, certainly, but increasingly in the cities of the developing world as well. We have very widespread adoption of locative and declarative media, for example, Foursquare, and now the ability to perform analytics, very much including things like sentiment analysis on the utterances we make in those spaces. Increasingly, we live not merely among declarative people, but declarative objects as well. This is a project from a London designer named Tom Armitage. He grafted a Twitter account onto London Bridge. At first, he fed this account manually, and later on, he hacked together. He scraped London Bridge's actual records to be able to allow London Bridge to speak to you in something approximating a human voice through the medium of Twitter, like, I am opening, I am closing, I'm about to pass. And this is a stand-in for a very, very large body of objects which are now increasingly speaking to us, with us, and receiving information from us. We also see objects and spaces with networked identities, informational shadows, like this building, the N building in Tokyo, which the entire facade of the building has been rendered as a QR code. And when you image the building with your camera, you get taken to a website describing the building. This one's a little iffy, but it, again, is a stand-in for a class of objects, services, spaces that increasingly we cannot fully understand except with reference to the network spaces that surround them. And most interestingly to me, our cities are increasingly becoming comprised of objects that are capable of gathering, processing, displaying, transmitting, and or taking physical action on information, which necessarily to me implies new modes of surveillance that do not always or even necessarily operate in the visual register. We've discussed some already today, and I'll be discussing some more in a couple of minutes. My contention to you is that tens of millions of people worldwide are already exposed to these conditions, and it occurs to me, and others as well, that just possibly we need a new theory and even probably a jurisprudence of public objects to help us guide how we think about them and interact with them. So I'd like to offer you a taxonomy of effects. I'd like to offer you a couple of very specific concrete systems that I've observed being deployed in our cities over the last several years, actually over the last 18 months or so, which gives us a way into thinking about what this class of objects implies for us, how we might wish to treat them, what sorts of rights and responsibilities we have with reference to them, and what sorts of rights and responsibilities the people who wish to deploy this class of artifacts has with reference to us. The first is something called the Valky traffic sensor. And I regard this as more or less an unobjectionable information gathering technology in public space. And I regard it as unobjectionable for two reasons. The first is it gathers local information and takes local effect upon it. This is a traffic safety beacon. It has a motion detector. It was invented by a Finnish company, and as if you know anything about Finland, you know that it's basically dark there 20 hours of the day and 10 months of the year. So they need something to protect people at traffic intersections. It's very, very hard to see pedestrians moving through public space, and the traffic fatality, particularly in the northern parts of Finland, has been very, very deleterious and significant. So this Finnish company designs this traffic beacon. It just has a motion detector. It detects when somebody, either a pedestrian or a bicyclist, is at a crossroads or a crosswalk, and shines a very bright blue LED at oncoming traffic to warn them of the presence of a person that they might not ordinarily otherwise be able to see. So again, a local effect on a local gathering of information. This information is not uploaded to the network. It is not archived. It's not databased. Inferential analytics are not applied to it. And very importantly, there's a clear public good that's associated with the function and the purpose of this object. It is entirely possible that there's somebody in this room that doesn't think that the ROI of having these out there is worth it. Nevertheless, I think we can all more or less agree, and I don't mean to prematurely seal hegemony, but I think we can more or less agree that traffic safety is a public good. Then we get into, from this, we get into something where I begin to have concerns. This is an ad for Nikon that was deployed in the subway system in Seoul last year. Again, a purely local use of local information, but for a different kind of purpose. Here we've got motion sensors that have been deployed underneath the red carpet that was laid down on the floor of the subway system. And as you pass this billboard, there are paparazzi in the advertising image. And as it detects motion past it, the paparazzi, you know, they all swivel, the cameras flash, and you feel as though you're walking down the red carpet in Cannes or in Hollywood or something like that. Again, you know, I'm not hugely threatened by this. I think that it's at worst sort of mildly disruptive and disrespectful. And the reason I have concern about it is that there is no consensus public good associated with this. There's a purely commercial motivation for it. So yes, it's gathering information. It's acting on that information. And it doesn't have at least the red herring of some kind of beneficial purpose associated with it. It is purely a commercial instantiation. And you know, it is an open question to me as to whether anything like this could successfully be regulated. It doesn't seem to cause harm to rise to a threshold of concern that would seem to justify that to me. And then we get into a system like this, which begins to raise those very concerns for me. This is a touchscreen vending machine that's been deployed in Tokyo since last year. It's called the Akude. And the design blogs were all over this because the entire front surface of the vending machine is a single touchscreen surface. There are very high resolution images of the things that are available in the vending machine. You touch it and you know, your purchase is delivered to you in this very kind of like high touch Japanese way. What's problematic about it to me is that every customer approaching the vending machine is not offered the same selection of consumables. There is a camera in the vending machine that attempts to characterize the person approaching it as to age and gender. And then the selection is tailored to a model of that age and gender in the norms of Japanese public life. I don't even know where to begin describing how problematic that is to me. It is both prescriptive and insidiously normative. And of course, all of that information is gathered up, is compared to all of the other networked vending machines in the system. Inferential models are built on that, and to not merely the future selection of beverages that are offered to individual consumers, but even potentially the kinds of beverages that are marketed, the kinds of beverages that are produced. So if you're the kind of person, as frankly I am, who tends to fall outside these models, if you tend to be sort of, you know, the anomaly that gets detected by the anomaly detector, guess what? You're kind of out of luck in this scenario. And again, there's no real public good associated with this gathering of information. There's a clear commercial purpose, and somebody stands to benefit from it. You could even argue that the person approaching it benefits in some way from it. They've been offering some kind of savings of time and or effort. But I'm not super thrilled about this. And then I get into the really scary stuff. This is a video advertising billboard analytics package that's offered for use with video advertising. It's called Kividi Vidi Reports, and it claims to be able to detect not merely your age to within four bands, not merely your gender, ethnicity off of indices of facial bone structure, and they even bounce a lamp off your eyeballs, and they can claim to detect whether you're paying attention or not. So again, predictive and prospectively normative. And something, this draws value up off of the streetscape in a very, very insidious way to me, because even if you're passing by in the background and you're not paying any attention to it at all, you're still a data point in the advertiser's analysis of what's going on. Even if you very deliberately choose to turn your back on this, you're still, in a way, generating value for some third party. And that value is never returned to either the city or the citizen. These things are interesting enough because it's easy for me to understand them. They're concrete, discrete objects. But I'm also concerned with the case where the power knowledge in this situation resides not merely in one object, but in an ensemble of discrete things. Here, a networked bollard in Barcelona, where the access control function is provided by the bollard itself. You see down at the bottom of the screen there. But the functionality of it is actually, it resides in this ensemble of like the data collection, that the embedded sensor grid there, and the RFID touch plate over there, and even the lighting and the signage and the wording of the law. I mean, this is an actor network that's brought to bear on people. And yet, most of us only ever understand it through the avatar of that bollard. So it can be a little bit difficult to understand. And it's even more difficult to understand when that effect resides not in the physical object itself, but in code. And the example I'll give you is that when I was in Wellington, New Zealand last year, I was told about a citizen referendum that the citizens were offered there. There was a ring of surveillance cameras that the city, the municipality, wanted to put up. And the justification that they offered to the public to vote on in the referendum was, we want these things for purposes of traffic safety. Well, people there thought that that was a pretty good justification. They voted yes on it. The cameras were installed. And the year after, an upgrade became available to the software at the back end of these cameras that permitted facial analysis, facial recognition, and all of a sudden, there's been mission creep. All of a sudden, the same ring of cameras is used by the police for a very, very different function indeed. And that upgrade in the software was never put to a referendum. And even to me, somebody so sort of public-minded as I like to think that I am, it's a little strange. I get the idea of putting a camera to a public referendum. Having for us to vote every single time somebody wants to upgrade a software package does feel a little strange to me. So I am just about out of time, and I'm really only into the interesting part now. If you'll indulge me and I can go a minute over, I think I can manage this. What I'm going to argue to you is that what we see here are a class of things that we should think of as public objects. And we should define them, and then we should begin having a conversation about what we want to do about them. Here's my definition of what a public object is. Any discrete object in the common spatial domain that's intended for the use and enjoyment of the general public, any artifact located in or bounding upon public rights of way, or any discrete object which is de facto shared by and accessible to the public, regardless of its ownership or original intention. And having defined public objects in that way, this is what I think we ought to be doing about them. I think we ought to ensure their openness. Where such objects are capable of the data collection activities that I've described here, they must be designed in such a way as to render the data streams they produce open and equally available. And by open, I mean as an API, in that their specifications are published and available to all, and that the data streams coming off of them are non-rivalrous and non-excludable. That is, that there is no way to restrict the goods of those data streams to paying customers, and that my use of that data stream in no way prevents anybody else's use of those data stream. There are, of course, issues, implications, and objections, but I'm already 1 minute and 50 seconds over, so I appreciate your indulging me. A city that's provided with such things where they are open necessarily and inevitably has an enormously increased attack surface. Vulnerability to hacking, vulnerability to griefing, vulnerability to disruption, almost to the point that you'd want to argue that doing things this way had better produce an awful lot of collective value if you're going to take this kind of risk with them. I would obviously argue, given my prejudices, biases, and assumptions, that is a risk worth taking, but by no means will everybody share that opinion, and I think this is a debate that pretty urgently needs to be had. I think that we have yet to develop the sorts of etiquettes and protocols of precedence and deconfliction that we have evolved over 7,000 years of the physical use of public space. It took us 100 years to learn how to live with automobiles in cities. I don't think we do it particularly well yet, and yet we have laws, we have etiquettes, we have standards of behavior that govern our interaction with this other order of mobile object in the city, and I would argue that this is something that, again, is going to require new thought about etiquettes and protocols. But why would you do such a thing? I think that it's justified to do this because it moves against the capture of public space by private interest, which is something that's very important to me. I think we move towards sort of a general purpose fabric of freely discoverable, addressable, queryable, and scriptable urban resources from which I can't even begin to anticipate now all of the potential upside uses to which everybody on Earth will be able to put these things. These will be the urban fabrics of the true deep mid-century. I think we're moving toward a place in this inscription of technology where the right to the city is meaningfully underwritten by the design of public space and the things in it, and if all goes well, toward a revitalized physical manifestation of the public sphere, which I think of it as the place where democracy happens and is seen to happen. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
While Jeff gets set up, let me ask you a question. The worst word that I hear in discussion of privacy is creepy. Right? We hear it all the time, and I always try to stop the conversation and say, define creepy. But we're going to regulate our world based on this odd, vague sense of creepiness. So that vending machine, I think I get it. It comes up, and it's telling you that we think you're a woman, so here's a product for you. And I'm guessing you're going to say that, why do you don't like that? It's because it's creepy. But let me go the next step and say, how would you solve that? It strikes me what you're also asking for is transparency in these devices, true of everything we have. So if the thing, if you walked up to it and it said to you, our computer thinks you're a woman, we're gonna give you these products, click here if you don't want this, wouldn't that kind of take away the creepiness? Wouldn't that kind of be okay? What's inherently creepy when we use targeting online? Why wouldn't physical objects use targeting as well?
Yeah, that's the tension that I'm working with, but I'm also a user experience guy, so one of the tensions that I cut against is that sort of flow of having to authorize the computer to do that on your behalf is just a very bad user experience. So,
but is it fixable?
I don't know. It's an intractable problem. I mean, I've been working, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I don't have a background in legal studies, so I've been working with my best available knowledge, which is about informed consent. Informed consent is the model that I've been working with in the design of all these systems. What I've heard this morning is that, better heads than I are saying that informed consent is no longer necessarily a tenable model for these interactions. And I take that very seriously. So I am the first to admit that I don't know how that's going to play out. I think we have to design protections for people into these systems, but not at the risk of so overburdening them with alert windows and dialogue boxes and those sorts of interaction that they just become untenable and unusable.
Okay. Jeff, over to you.
Okay, good afternoon. I would like to continue the spirit of disciplinary mashup and present or talk about the risks and beauties of hyperpublic from an architect's point of view. And I would like to use a real project as a case study to discuss the issues. The case study, the project, is the design of a new campus in the deserts of Ras El Khaimah. I'm not sure how many of you know where Ras El Khaimah is. Ras El Khaimah is one of the seven emirates in the UAE, so it's located in the Persian Gulf. It is about 1 hour northeast of Dubai and 2 hours northeast of Abu Dhabi. In 2009, the Sheikh of Ras El Khaimah agreed to fund the joint development of a campus together with the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, EPFL, where I'm located, with the ambition to first focus on a few key academic issues that deals with the particularity of that site, with energy, solar energy, wind energy, water management, and urbanism in an extreme climate, but then to later scale up to become a knowledge city. The site that was given is this double rectangle here in the middle of the desert, on a road that connects the new Ras El Khaimah to an airport that is now being constructed. We were asked last summer to look at the project and develop proposals or ideas of what a campus could be in this century at this particular location. These are a few images from the site visit. So there's really nothing around, only deserts, but it's a beautiful desert. At sunset, it becomes completely red. The program itself is quite straightforward. There's a learning centers, which is learning activities, auditorium, classrooms, libraries. Then there are labs around it, common social areas like cafeteria, prayer rooms, and restaurants. And then major infrastructures and lodging and sports. Maybe the only difference is the strict separation of male and female students here. Now, the idea started with the initial idea for the project was that rather than creating a typically closed, completely closed, gated campus, which pushes the ultimate of privateness, the project really started with the desire to do the opposite and explore how public could we go. Could we create a space inside the campus that would be more public than what is around it? We also wanted to avoid typical developments in the Middle East that look like gigantic golf courts with some houses around it, so resorts that uses a lot of green, which in turn uses, of course, an absurd amount of water. And instead, we proposed a bottom-up, data-driven approach where we map the climatic particularities of the site, the wind, the water, the sun. The ambition was to grow a campus where it makes sense ecologically, so to build buildings where there's natural cooling from winds or where there's natural shading from the topography, and to grow parks where there's natural water from the rain or from the groundwater. Here you see a map of the water spots or the low points, natural low points where water naturally accumulates. And the proposal was to use these points and turn them into oases, micro-oases, around which then the campus would be organized. So here are some early visuals that have been created by one of our students, Jeanne Wellinger. So this is actually a project that we took on as an academic project with a design studio. Architecturally, the space is a large, completely fluid, open space where the condition of seeing and being seen is maximized. Essentially, it is a multiplication of another building, the EPFL Learning Center, which is the partner institution that Laurent also showed this morning, where, again, you have a space without solid walls. Everything is fluid. But when you're inside, the complete publicness, the fact that you can see everyone and everyone can see you, is actually not disturbing at all, but rather gives you a sense of comfort, a sense of safety, perhaps similar to what you feel when you're in a Swiss city where everyone cares for you and is watching what you're doing. From a digital technology point of view, the plan was to create a network of sensors that would sense the location, movements, and activities of people inside, so that the campus would have an awareness of what's going on inside and could greet visitors by the name or provide personal services, not unlike what you know from Minority Report. Or you could find someone inside the whole campus by conducting searches in real time, physical search. And by displaying the data shadows of people, the campus or the buildings could also accelerate chance encounters, perhaps, or suggest affinities among people. Of course, if you have all those kinds of proposals, there's the question of the risks and dangers of privacy, and privacy in invasion becomes inevitable. And the question is really whether you actually, there is a necessity to actually design the privacy just like we designed the publicness, whether there's a necessity to have little shelters, little walls, or even devices like scrumming devices, like this one. I think that Adam, you're involved in this project. But our position is that there should be less and less, even no necessity to design the private if and only if the publicness, the hyper publicness of the space is adequately designed. So if, especially if there's, for example, no central or private entity owning the data, or there's full transparency over who looks at the data or what is actually being captured and made explicit and visible, such as in this art project by Marie Sester. Okay.
Quick question for you. I've been to the Emirates only once, but the thing that strikes my memory is the high walls around every home and everything. How culturally do you enter this notion of hyper-transparency into a culture that seems so closed behind walls?
Well, this is a bit the whole premise of the project. Instead of gating what is inside the campus, to create a privacy or publicness differential that is larger inside than outside, right? But I don't think it's a problem over there. Crime rates are low, if that's the problem.
I don't know why the walls are there. I'm just saying the walls are there. So are you going to get, do you anticipate some resistance from local people to this very different view of their world?
No.
No, okay. Good. That's it.
So I have no slides, which I apologize for. Can you all hear me? So I work at Google on the global public policy team. And in that role, I lead our policy efforts on privacy globally. So I'm coming at this from a very different perspective. And I have very little to say that's new, which is going to make it quite different from the previous two talks. But that in itself might be sort of illustrative of the different perspective that a practitioner would bring to this. So I got the invitation to participate in this panel, and I looked at the title. And I skipped over the word risks, because I didn't quite read it all carefully. And I said, the beauty of a hyper-public life, why would anyone invite me to talk about that? Because, like, I can't actually see much beauty in it. Because to me, the framing, a hyper-public life, implies a Paris Hilton-like existence, right? It implies this, you're publishing stuff about yourself, constantly streaming to the world, and making your, not just your identity, but your behavior and your identifiable behavior available for everyone to watch and see. And then I read the description of the panel, and the description actually implied something quite different. The description implied a data-driven life. And that's much closer to what these guys are talking about, right? And I want to make that distinction very explicit, because from the perspective of somebody who's practicing this stuff day to day on the actual discussions that are happening today in the policy world, that distinction can be blurry. And it's really important, I think, that we draw the distinction cleanly. There's a tremendous amount of good that can come from data-driven services, and I would say that is the beauty of what we're talking about in this panel, right? Is predictive analytics and what that type of analysis can provide the world. The types of examples that people from Google talk about all the time are things like Google Flu Trends. Does everyone in the room know what that is? I won't go into explanation if you all do. Looks like yes. Other examples of that, right, we continue to build those types of tools out, dengue trends. We've recently made that data, the underlying data set that we use to build those tools, publicly accessible via an API, right? So very much in line with some of the things that Adam was saying. There's a tremendous amount of public good there that we can get at with big data analysis. There's also some just like baseline economic good, right? So a study out of Europe last September found 100 billion euros of consumer surplus from advertising, right? So I think in the privacy community, we like to sort of demonize advertising. That's a tremendous amount of value that's created for consumers above and beyond anything that anybody is paying or generating in revenue, right? So there's a lot of good that can come from this type of predictive analytics. I typically think about those predictive tools in two ways, and there's just one design question in here for the room. And the first way to think about it is predictive analytics for you based on your own behavior, right? So Amazon, Netflix, recommendation engines, right? It's very clear in those systems. They've designed it in really clearly to say, this is the data that we are using to give you a prediction about what you might like. It's very clear to the end user what's going on, and the privacy concerns are a lot more minimal, right? The second type is a prediction for you based on primarily other people's behavior. And into this, I would classify things like search, things like flu trends, and actually like the soda machine that Adam was talking about, right? Where you're saying, well, a lot of women happen to like this soda. We think you're a woman. Here's a soda. And we can talk about the benefits of each of those types of predictive models, and we could talk about how we should or shouldn't be using them. I think it's fair to say that both create a tremendous amount of value. And so then you ask, what's the risk? Because we're talking about the beauty and risks of a data-driven life, if I can just sort of rephrase it. I actually think the risk is a hyper-public life, right? So the risk of all of this data-driven living is that at some point, all of that data gets attached to us in a way that it can be positioned on itself in one context. So all of the contexts of your life collapse on each other. The data is re-identified and attached to your identity. And this is the underlying fear that a lot of people who are concerned about privacy are advocating on the basis of. I think there's a piece of that that is missing. It simplifies the statement just a little bit. And I'm going to posit a potential solution, which is similar to what folks have talked about here. I got on the plane to get out here Wednesday night, and just a small digression. I was in SFO, they have free Wi-Fi. I turned on my Kindle, I tried to download a book that I'd purchased the night before. And SFO Wi-Fi let me down. I couldn't get the book before I got on the plane, so I was stuck with my existing library. And I stumbled on a collection of Jonathan Franzen essays. And now I'm just curious how late I was to the game. Do people in the room know the Jonathan Franzen essay, The Imperial Bedroom? Okay, so I wasn't that late to the game. This is a great essay from 1998 about privacy following the Lewinsky scandal. And it was a really interesting commentary on privacy. I would encourage you guys to go read it. It was quite counterintuitive for me, as someone who at the time that it was written just was, you know, totally unaware of these issues. He said something really interesting in this essay. He said, without shame, there can be no distinction between public and private. The reason I found that interesting is because if you think about shame and what actually sort of causes somebody to feel shame, I don't think it's absolutely true that without identity you can't feel shame. I think you could feel shame even if your behavior was anonymous. But for the most part, the more identifiable you are in doing some sort of behavior that is quote unquote shameful, the more likely you are to feel that shame, because you're going to feel the perceptions of all the people around you who know what you've done. And so that brings me to this posited solution, right? Which is that the design problem that we have ahead of us is how to construct multiple identities and manage multiple identities, and how to preserve some degree of anonymity and manage that degree of anonymity. And I know a lot of people in the room, we've already heard it today, that anonymity is effectively dead. It will become trivial to re-identify you. Alessandro's work on face recognition and social security numbers. And there's definitely a degree of truth in that. I don't know that we've explored all the policy options available to us in that space. So if you have otherwise anonymous data, are there policy requirements that we could put on the data controller so that there was a punishment for re-identifying users of that data set? This is the sort of thing that Jane Jakowitz at Brooklyn Law School is proposing, and it's an interesting idea. So I think we could be exploring some policy options there. And I think on the design side, there's a lot we can do to think about managing multiple identities online in different online spaces that would augment some of the work that folks have talked about today around designing spaces to enable users to express different sides of themselves.
Let me ask one question, then I'll come out and play. Well, I used to say I'd play Oprah, now I guess I'll play Katie.
Not a big pop culture group.
Yes.
And for those of my age with my hair color, Phil. This question, what we heard before, mentions of multiple publics, yep. Right? That rather than the notion of having one public sphere, in fact, we have this opportunity to create many, many publics and to join those publics, create and join those publics, act with those publics. That's an important thing. It's related and unrelated to the idea of multiple identities, right? And Mark Zuckerberg has said, and I tend to agree with him on this, that we have one identity, and in our efforts to keep separate identities, when those come into conflict, so when we have a problem, I think the real identities we're trying to keep out of conflict are our internal selves, our real selves and our show selves. When those come into conflict, we've got problems. But we'll put that aside for a second. In the EU, there's talk of trying to bring in a right to be forgotten. Well, that brings in a whole nother tension, because if I'm the one remembering you and I'm now ordered to forget you, then my free speech is impinged upon. So I'm trying to understand here, you're surprising me here in your kind of fear of the collection of data and its association with a person. In a minute I'm going to get to its association with a thing, but we'll get there in a place. But going for a little bit more on that you're fearing that we're all turned into Paris Hilton, that we're all made more public. Is that what I'm hearing you say? And then okay, if that's the case, stipulated, Your Honor. But what is it you want to do about that?
So I think I'm suggesting that the hyper-public identity is constructed from the collapse of contexts beyond sort of beyond the expectation of the individual who's using whatever technology it is, right? And this is why you continue to see so many privacy concerns come up, because people just aren't aware of the variety of different contexts that are collapsing on their mobile phone, for example. Right? You're moving from place to place, and all of those contexts and the people in them are becoming one. And I don't think that many people actually want that. I think they want a separation of the data that's used to personalize an advertisement for them from the data that they are sharing with their friends. I think that people want some separation of that, and they want the ability to maintain and control that separation. I think it's quite different from the right to be forgotten. What I'm suggesting the ability to understand and maintain those different sort of silos of data about you and your behavior.
That's the break wall of the discussion this morning, in a sense, is that the data's there. If Dana were here, I would call on her now.
Yeah.
And she helped me immensely in my research for my book in separating gathering versus use of data. That if you try to restrict the gathering of data, you're telling people they cannot hear something they heard, they cannot learn something they've learned, they can't know something they know. It becomes absurd after a while.
Right.
But if you say you can't use this data in a way, then that's a different issue.
Right.
I'm not sure where you come across on that, because in a sense you're saying you want to be able to silo the data, and so
effectively restrict the use, right? So if you have otherwise anonymous data and you say this data could be used for research purposes or for product development purposes, but the second you go and re-identify it, you have somehow violated a law or some other sort of policy solution you could put in place that limits the use of that otherwise anonymous data, so that the risks of re-identification and the risks of context collapse are minimized.
Okay, I've got to tie this back to Google, of course, because I would think that as a matter of principle, Google would want as few restrictions that are hard to interpret and hard to know on data as possible. That context is very difficult. That means you've got to have, if it's not collected, if it's not obvious what the context is when the data is collected, to have to go then back and find out the context or intuit the context, or you should have known the context, creates a liability for the likes of Google, doesn't it?
That's the design challenge, right? is helping users understand that and maintain the identities. And so that's where, when I talk about, you know, the two forms of predictive analytics, and where Amazon and Netflix and recommendation engines have done something really good in helping users understand that data, I don't think, for example, search engines or the soda machine have really gotten it quite right yet. We aren't helping users understand that. You don't think Amazon's got it quite right?
I'm going to go back to that one second. What I think, you know, this being Berkman, and Berkman being the incredible leader in thinking about the internet in this country, and now with this wonderful tie to architecture in both senses of the word, I would love to see some senses of the principles that come out of this discussion today, mm-hmm. right? What are the emerging principles that we're trying to talk about here? And I hear context, though, as I say, context is, I think, is very difficult mm-hmm. to deal with. It's a very complex. I hear usage from Dana. I hear control, though that's difficult too. I hear transparency in our discussion before that you mentioned as a context. So, you know, what are the appropriate behaviors that enable a public and public discussion to be created that at the same time preserve the rights and privacies that we have and where that goes? So what does Amazon do wrong, or what could they do better? What's the lesson?
Well, I mean, that particular question is less interesting to me than transparency and usage. I mean,
I still want to hear what Amazon does wrong. Just for
oh, quick, really?
Quick, yeah, quick second.
Harry Potter issue, right? The massively popular things badly skew their recommendation algorithm. So,
oh, okay.
You know, I'll get continually, I can't stand fantasy. And yet,
so it's not a matter of principle, it's a matter of execution.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of both.
Okay, all right, yeah. All right. Okay, keep going then, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, one of the things that I tried to inscribe in my distinction between the things which were like kind of less problematic and less threatening and more problematic and more injurious was the local use of locally gathered information. And to my mind, if you're just acting on something in its immediate physical ambit, that is, and you know, space and time, that is ultimately going to be less of an issue for me personally than something. I mean, I just don't believe in anonymous data anymore. I don't think that we can speak of anonymous data unless something is in perfect and serene isolation.
You don't think we can create policies to maintain the anonymity? I mean, you're right in the sense that you pull multiple data sets together, yeah. You can re-identify
Trivial.
Anything, right?
Yeah.
But couldn't we create an accountability framework in which that data was walled off effectively for use?
In law, but not necessarily in practice.
But isn't there? But it's worth trying,
yeah.
You know, because one of Google's founders has said that if we use the flu trends to predict the next pandemic, we could save, in his perhaps overblown calculation, a third of the population of Earth.
So there's some.
It's
context,
worth trying.
There's some contexts in which predictive analytics of that form, you know, don't really bother me at all. But there are other contexts in which predictive analytics so clearly cut against our social contract. I mean, think about. You know, the police would love to be able to use predictive analytics to cite resources and to say, well, we know where the last 15 murders in the city have occurred, and, you know, we're going to, like, locate our resources in neighborhoods where we know that crime is about to happen, right? It stands to reason. And yet it cuts against our entire history of law and jurisprudence, and it's redlining, right? I mean, it's going to lead to that sort of thing, inevitably and wherever enacted. And I think, you know, if we can see that... You don't think that's...
No, I think it's going too far. I think that's good budgeting.
I think it's
sensible.
I know a lot
if
of
you're,
people...
If the argument is that police could prevent someone from being murdered, how is it a bad thing to have them try to do that in that context?
If it leads to kinds of profiling that are injurious to people's lives...
That's a different question. That's a different question.
I don't think it is. I think the two things have become very
similar. That's where you go back to this idea, Shiv. You're not allowed to know that. You're not allowed to act on that. So that if you say we have to have, by a matter of principle, the same number of police per square mile throughout the whole place...
No, that would be an absurdity.
That's where you're headed.
Not necessarily. I don't know. I mean, I think this could require an afternoon.
All right, fine. We'll
pick it up. Yeah.
Jeff, you displayed that magnificent image of someone's data shadow, as you put it, being displayed, which I kind of love, as long as everybody knows what's going on and you talk about controls over that. But back to creepiness, I hear people talk about using AR with, you know, the fact that we can use facial recognition, the fact that with AR we could have Google goggles tell us, you know, I could scan the room and find out, you know, Weinberger's a vegetarian and that, you know, that Ethan does this and so on and so forth. That I hear often is described as creepy. So what are the I think the value of what you propose is great. What are the principles that you would try to have to make it operate in such a way that people would welcome it rather than call you creepy?
Well, I have a 16-year-old son who's currently doing his final exams in high school. And it's in the inner city school in Switzerland, so there's a lot of cheating going on. And we've been talking a little bit earlier about how we could redesign the space to encourage probably better interaction and maybe even a fairer way of acting, right? And I think that the anxiety of those kids are mainly that it's such a lack of tracking of what people are doing, right? Because the fair people who not cheat are getting punished in a world where the information is incomplete, right?
So there's a benefit to them.
I think there's a benefit to
have their identities tied to the information that is legitimate about them.
Well, I think the whole thing about the hyperpublic and this campus that we're creating is a bit based on the premise that if you're an honest citizen, if you're a good person, you benefit from things being public and open.
I agree. When I drove into Amsterdam last hour, I was driven into Amsterdam, and we hit some point in the road. Everyone slowed down to the speed limit. Everyone, and I was, as an American, I was freaked. Right, what's going on here? And the driver said, "Oh, it's a sensor, and we'll all get tickets." So on the one hand, logically, that makes perfect sense. To an American, it seems creepy. It seems like a bad local use of this data, right? Logically, it says we're gonna reduce accidents and save lives, and it's a good thing. But it's a case where our norms and our laws just and our technology just don't match yet, right? If you could all be in Google's auto-driven car, that would be wonderful, but we lose control. We don't like that. This is exactly what we're trying to negotiate now. Benefit.
Yeah.
We're talking too much about fear, I think, and not enough about benefit.
I think this is a slightly different issue. I think this ties in into what Betsy was saying about shame and shamefulness. I think the more you are shameful about something, the more you fear this lack of privacy, right?
Yes, but that'll strike some as puritanical. Not that you're from the birthplace of that, yes. There's a little Calvinistic in, and I don't disagree with you, but I think that's the fear, is that somehow it becomes kind of a judgment matter. That goes to Eric Schmidt's line that if you're going to be ashamed of people knowing they should do this, then you shouldn't perhaps be doing it, which I think makes perfect sense, but got, as often Eric Schmidt lines are tweeted and misconstrued. What do you think of that construction right there? I would think that you'd be...
It has never historically sat well with me.
I didn't figure it would, yes.
Yeah.
Let me come on out and get the discussion going larger. Anybody?
It sounds like it's a question of abuse. Like a hyperpublic design would be very good, but then looks like maybe we need to have systems in place that part of the design should be to prevent abuse, because the one person's concern about abusing the system, if you take the predictive analytics, essentially you're still guessing and you could get it wrong, and humans tend to be lazy and we rely on it too much. And so maybe, like, how do you prevent people from overly relying on something that's just a guesswork?
You and I were talking earlier about the social network you're trying to create, and that part of the issue, and I was talking with someone else here about a social network, that part of the issue here is the expectation of it, that if Facebook were presented as a sharing service, the whole reason to be here is just to share, Twitter-like, then the fears about privacy would be lessened, right? So the definition of abuse goes into the prediction, the what you think this thing does, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's where the Harry Potter thing comes to, because the prediction algorithm is not doing its job right. That's why you said it's about the execution. So maybe we're relying on it too much as opposed to being aware of it, but maybe it should be part of the design itself to not rely on it so much.
I should point out too that, like, Amazon, I mean, I've bought one book a week from Amazon since 1997. Amazon has more information about me, my habits, my behaviors and predilections as expressed through the exchange of hard currency than any other organization on earth, including Google, and they're still recommending Harry Potter to me.
So, you can fix that, but it provides the means. You can say, don't use this again. It gave you the power, you just want to complain about it.
No, I do use that. I check that box. It comes back up. There's something in...
You can't kill Harry Potter.
Well, this is what we're being
told. I'm sympathetic to your travail.
Maybe you should just read it.
Yeah, like, that's not normative. Come on.
Over here.
Hi, I'm Jean Rosenberg from Baruch College in CUNY. This week, a couple of conversations came up around privacy. Yesterday at Berkman, and before that at a corporate council conference that I attended. And I'm interested in getting the panel's read on it. When you think about privacy and what you've been discussing the privacy interests of the individual and what's at risk when that individual loses you know, some of his or her privacy, but what about risks relating to third-party abuse, such as the example of insider trading? If you've got a CEO of one company that's going to some, you know, small Midwestern city, and so someone third-party can kind of put together that maybe there's some deal that's in the works, and then take advantage of that and basically take advantage of investors who don't have that information, who haven't researched that.
Sure.
Or what about an example that some of the media team were talking about yesterday of knowing someone's location and then being able to break into that person's house? You know, what about abuse of information in ways that aren't necessarily offensive to the person, to the individual in terms of their privacy, but that can cause risks to their safety or can cause, you know, some risk to their property?
Or, you know, what about when they are offensive? I mean, you know, we were told when the backscatter and millimeter wave machines were introduced at the airports that, that, you know, those scans would be like locked up and never available to any third party. And, you know, very, very early on, it became obvious to everybody who had any knowledge of those machines whatsoever that, that these printouts were being passed around by the TSA people, that they were escaping from the containment that was designed for them. And that in principle, there's no way to design these sort of perfect isolation bubbles in which these, the, you know, these facts can reside. So I tend to think the Canadian Office of the Privacy Commissioner has a little piece of doggerel that they use that it's a little cute, but it makes a lot of sense to me. It says, if you can't protect it, don't collect it. And that has to be my bottom line on all of this stuff, even if there is value that might be mined from that information in the future. If you have no way of protecting that information, then you have to assume that some harm can come to vest in the lives and the life choices of the people that that information has been gathered from. And that's, you know, that's what doctors have been doing for millennia, right? Like, first, do no harm. And that should be our principle here as well. I'm just not convinced by the notion that there's all this amazing benefit out there to be derived from this that outweighs the potential damage, to, particularly to vulnerable individuals.
But go ahead.
Well, I'm all for protection of privacy, it's not that. But in the two examples that have been talked about, the Harry Potter example or the intruders who gets the information to get into a house, into your house, the problem there is really that the information is not complete. There's not enough information. Amazon doesn't know enough about you, otherwise it wouldn't. If the system would know about the intruders, that wouldn't happen either, right?
So it's an uncanny valley problem. We've got almost enough information, but not quite a perfect amount.
Yeah, so you can either try to hold it back or push it further. It's like a train that goes perhaps in the wrong direction, but at least accelerate it so that it crashes. But at this point, you're just holding something back that is...
I want that to be the design principle that's built in everything. You know, push it further so that at least it crashes. I think that's beautiful.
there's another angle here that's worth mentioning, right, which is... you can maybe get both worlds. So the location example of, I don't know if it's Facebook or Foursquare, where it was like the please rob me thing. That's an individual with an identity posting their location, right? The flip side of that is anonymous collection of location data like that is done in sort of the location services industry at large, right? Where it actually does provide tremendous value, and you can capture that value while protecting the identified data set. And I think that's the distinction that is most interesting to me, right? Is how do you get the latter bit of that while protecting the identities involved so that you can prevent that type of breach?
This is turning into the classic discussion we have these days around fear and privacy. If that notion of if you can't protect it, don't collect it means that you'll never collect anything because you're always managing to the worst possible case. The highest common denominator of fear and liability.
But what's
if something
wrong with
could
that?
Go wrong with it, then you shouldn't collect it. I don't want to live in that world. I really don't. By the way, well, you see, but I'm a weird guy. I wanted to use my TSA scan as my author photo. Over here.
I wanted to push back on to the panelists who paint this picture of privacy is really, you know, don't, if you have something to hide, don't share, you know, only the people who have something to hide are the ones who won't share it. I'm reminded of many years ago, one of my first tasks was for a cancer registry, a disease registry, and they wanted to make sure that people who had HIV diagnosis were not released. And so it's a very simple thing. You have HIV, we're not supposed to release that information. But now you have a list of all these patients, and the only ones blotted out are the ones who have HIV. So it became immediately clear to me that privacy can't be the issue of hiding only that which you, from an individual perspective. That in the case of that registry, it had to be a kind of societal value, and that I had to also suppress other people who didn't have HIV in order to protect the people who did have HIV and adhere to this societal regulation.
Well, I'll come back to you first myself. Right, so but then you affected those people whom you also blotted out. I wrote about my prostate cancer. I got incredible benefit by doing it under my name. It was my choice, and it was easy for me to do it because I'm a white American male in the US and I'm public and obnoxious. But I got incredible value back because my name was attached. I got friends who brought me advice, who brought me benefit that I could not have gotten otherwise. Right? So in the effort to come up with the safe rule for all, you affect people in two ways.
Actually, that's not correct. So remember, I live in the world of parallel universes. The universe that I talked about was the universe where we have a regulation that who couldn't find out about your prostate cancer, you couldn't find out it from this source. It didn't mean that there didn't exist another universe in which you could find out about it, and the example you gave was one where you gave that information.
Any other reaction to this? Or?
I think Tanya's point is a very profound one. I wanted to go back to a point Betsy made a couple of times, actually, in what she was saying, which had to do with maybe going back to a point, again, in Tanya's slides this morning, maybe this isn't actually a trade-off at all. Maybe you can have both. Maybe you can have privacy protection and still have a flourishing advertising ecosystem. And one observation I make is that what makes us individuals are the differences between us. Even identical twins are different. But what makes us economically valuable is our similarities. Do you think that that leads us to any kind of potential solution to some of the intractable problems we've been discussing?
I'm not sure I completely understood the question, so let's see if my response makes any sense. What you said resonates, right, in the sense that the types of value that I think about from big data is, I mean, Jeff, point taken that there's value in you sharing your individual life history, but I'm actually more interested in the aggregate sort of analysis of social data, where you do actually find similarities, right? You're applying statistical machine learning to a big data set to learn something interesting about that big data set. You don't need to reveal anything about the individual pieces of data in there, even though, as has been pointed out, any one of those individual pieces of data is probably re-identifiable in some theoretical world, right? And so I think you can put in systems to provide accountability and protection of that aggregate data set to protect against that risk.
Spot on. I mean, I think your response was gratifying. I think it also goes beyond economic value. If you're looking at an individual and those individual characteristics, and they are unique, from a medical point of view, you're in the territory of Dr. House, Freakville, medical detective work. For most people, it's the similarities that let doctors diagnose the problems we have. So I think what you say is potentially also applicable in medical record protection.
We have time for a few more.
I wanted to go back to some of the examples you gave, Adam. And you talked about how this morning there was a lot of talk about how informed consent might not be the paradigm in which we are moving towards. It seems to me that there's a possibility that we're moving towards what might be called uninformed consent. And I was wondering if that you find if that's the case, where we interact, where we have the option to choose to engage with systems but are not really told the results of what that system is doing or collecting, if you see that as a trend, and if it's so, whether it's problematic.
Yeah, so the construction I apply to these things is very much about another distinction, which the morning also revealed to be increasingly problematic, which is that between public and private space, right? I mean, if we're blurring the thresholds and boundaries between these conditions, then some of the things that I'm talking about and asking for don't really hold up very well, and we should be really clear about that. The existence of a screen that's capable of capturing biometric identifying information about you doesn't bother me if it's in the Prada store. It doesn't bother me if it's in Walmart. It doesn't bother me if it's in McDonald's, because in some senses, you've consented to that by crossing the threshold, right? And I think that there's probably that could be argued as well, but as sort of a clear identifying marker for me where you know, that's not my domain, that's not what I'm designing for. I'm designing for what we traditionally call public space and the condition of the street. And in that context, there's no way to inform you or achieve your consent. Your consent is implicit. Your consent is bound up in the action of passing in front of a screen like that. And again, you know, I might not be the most effective advocate for the things that I believe, but that doesn't sit right with me, just as somebody who walks through the streets of the city. Do I have anything that I necessarily need to feel guilty about? I don't know. I don't know that that's the question, though. Are there policies and procedures which could be enacted on the basis of that information which would be detrimental to me or run strongly at variance with my desires? Absolutely, and that has nothing to do with shame or guilt or any of those interiorities. So again, there's this sort of user experience challenge. I mean, if you're gonna design something that lives in public space and is gonna be gathering that information, and there is this burden upon you to inform people of that, and to you know, get some kind of acquiescence from them, some kind of formal acquiescence from them before proceeding with that, how do you design that into a situation where somebody's walking past that at normal speed and the engagement itself might last a third of a second? If you can't respond to that in a meaningful way, then I think you ought not to be deploying that technology there. What I'm interested in doing right now, personally, as a designer, is finding out a lot more about the future history of informed consent, because frankly, it's the model that I've built a lot of my assumptions on. And if that's kind of being subjected to evolutionary pressure at this moment in history, oh boy, I better need to find out about what comes next, because it is implicit in what I designed that there is this model of agency and consent.
Thanks, Jenny Toomey. How many of you guys have ever heard of the band or the individual musician Momus? Because he has a great song called The Age of Information, which definitely runs into the sort of utopic language around this, where basically the substance of the song is, in the future, everyone will know everything about you, and they will decide whether they're your friend based on who you actually are, which I think was really contemporaneous to what the 15 years ago when he wrote it. It was a very utopic, exciting idea of a song. But I wanted to push back on two memes that I keep hearing in this space and that came out on this panel as well that I'm not sure if I believe. And the first one, LaTanya addressed very clearly, which is, you know, this idea that if you don't have anything to hide, you're going to benefit. And I really don't agree with that. And I actually heard Evan Moglen on Science Friday a couple weeks ago just saying it very clearly. You know, while it may be true that you're not doing anything that is wrong, there have been things historically that are always private, where your children are, you know, what medications you take, you know, what your symptoms are from your insurance companies at a certain moment. There are real reasons for this level of privacy, and I think to contest it is crazy. The second thing I would just say, though, is this meme that's come out on this panel around the idea that privacy is only about shame, I think, is a very narrow definition of the benefits and values of privacy, and that I may look at my husband in a private way, I may have shared stories with my best friends that are private, that are nothing about shame at all, but that are about a level of intimacy that I am granting to them. And the idea that somehow all of this is fair game in the future seems crazy to me. So positive idea behind it, not just shame.
Just for clarity, do we think anybody said that the privacy is only a matter of shame?
I heard that a couple times.
I quoted Jonathan Franzen, who wrote it.
But Franzen, yeah, but I don't
yeah,
think
it wasn't necessarily expressing this my own view. It was just an interesting quote, I thought.
Just for clarity, I don't think that, relax, the meme is not taken off as badly as you think. That's all I'm trying to suggest.
Hi, Jackie Kerr. I wanted to add to that, actually, on shame. My immediate reaction to that quote was I thought it was a great quote, But I also I've studied Soviet history, and I thought of Joseph Brodsky's essays about the need to hide in private kitchen settings to have real conversation during the late Soviet period. And I think that privacy can be constructed as being only about shame in a perfectly democratic society, perhaps, but certainly not in any society in which the public norms are not viewed as legitimate by all in that society. And in any non-democratic society, you really run into those issues. And I just thought that was a point worth throwing out there for the discussion. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, we know historically as a matter of mission creep, if information can be collected and used against you, then ultimately it will be used against you. We know that historically, like across the board. And that's what, you know, we live in a democratic society at the moment. I'm grateful for that. But I think to assume that the society will always be democratic and that information will always have the protections it has now is fatuous, in my personal opinion. So I completely agree with you.
Dystopian and utopian are
no, it's, Jeff, it's not a dystopia.
I think that's a dystopia, yeah.
It's historical.
I'm not going to speak myself. We have two.
Hi, Shreya Murthy, a Berkman intern. I'm actually writing a paper right now reviewing the work of Daniel Solov, who, if any of you guys are interested in a sort of like the legal and philosophical basis of the way we think about privacy, specifically in the courts, it's an excellent read. He's got a paper called The Taxonomy of Privacy. And one thing that I think is really relevant to, you know, the idea of like shame as being, the main justification for a right to privacy, the courts have actually recognized that there is such a thing as dignitary harm, which occurs when privacy is breached, that there's a certain sense of your person and your personal effects that is harmed when there is a breach of privacy. And I just think that that's something that, you know, we should recognize. This is an understood concept, that there is something specifically wrong with putting a person in a position where they don't feel comfortable acting freely or thinking freely or doing anything that they, in a society that recognizes free speech as such an important value, should be able to do.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just about the transition to totalitarianism, it's about the transition out of totalitarianism as well. I mean, one of my favorite historical examples is all the information that was collected by the East German security state, wound up in the Stasi archives. When that regime fell, that information became freely accessible all of a sudden, and people's life chances were harmed by it. And only in retrospect did, you know, people judge them on the basis of the actions that were taken 20 or 30 years ago without having any understanding about the things
stipulated, Your Honor, bad things can happen, but if all I'm trying to say is if all we do is manage every choice we have and we don't join in with our fellow human beings enough because of these fears, I think we're going to lose the benefit and the power of this tool of publicness that we now, thank you, internet folks, have.
I think the fear is really relevant. I mean, that you keep bringing this concept, I think is very important, because it seems to me that we are still in the paradigm of the Benham paradigm. We are being watched. We don't know when, by who is collecting our data. So we are all imprisoned in a way, a society, in this condition, if we follow what Adam is saying, for example, right? But there are other aspects of it. I mean, our notions of privacy keep changing. Our notion of privacy is not the same that it was in the Victorian age or that it was even before. This morning somebody said that privacy basically started in the Victorian age. You say something about quoting someone about shame, but shame is also, you know, defined culturally. Robin Evans wrote a very beautiful article called Figures, Doors, and Passages, where analyzing architectural space, he talked about how in the space of the Renaissance there are these palaces that lead from one room to another, and people will be passing by, and people will be making love or defecating or everything, and everybody had a sense of privacy, despite the fact that they are being exposed, right? So the introduction of the wall in architecture to separate what is private and public is historical, too, as it is the deconstruction of that wall with the open plan of Le Corbusier, etc. So we are in a new paradigm where definitions of what is private and public are changing. And you know, for example, a couple of years ago there was an article in the New York Times, maybe it's now 10 years ago. The manufacturers of cordons and sails were all going out of business because people didn't think anymore that they have to have them, right? So in an age in which we are all so much more exposed through new media, people didn't feel, I mean, that the cordon in your wall was such a kind of quaint thing to have, right? So we are more able, and then our concerns with privacy have changed too. As it has been repeatedly said, it has more to do with our medical histories than with other aspects that may have preoccupied the Victorian age, right? So what is interesting, I think, about this conversation is that it expresses the fears of us as a society in multiple ways, and that's what we should be paying attention to. What is our...
Yeah, I think where we'll agree in the end of it is that one is making a bet on the future. So when a gay or lesbian person comes out and uses the power of that publicness to fight down the bigots and gets married in public and is registered, they're making a bet that they're not going to find a backlash and turnaround, that gays will again be shoved back in the closet, whether it's totalitarian governments or anything. And that's a bet that one chooses to make on optimism. And that's the kind of negotiation we're going through right now. I think we've run out of time entirely. Anybody want to respond to that? Or okay, I want to thank the panel very much for a discussion that went in surprising ways.